Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Rambling Ravenclaw podcast. We have a special guest today. I'm going to let him introduce himself with his pronouns if he wants to, if he's he, him. If he's not, he can correct it right now. But go ahead and introduce yourself, sir.
Hi, my name is Jesse Carlson. I'm he, him, and I'm grateful to be here.
Well, thank you so much. I found your Instagram when I was scrolling, just like on a chance. I love the messages that you have for second chances. You want to talk a little bit about like how you got into second chances for other people, like why it's such a big deal for you?
Sure. Other people getting a second chance is such a big deal because I'm living one right now. When I was 18 years old, I was sentenced to serve 32 years in prison, and it's not for a crime I didn't commit. It's absolutely for things that I was guilty of. And there was this struggle with accountability because I was sentenced to twice the high point of the guidelines. So rather than the 10 to 16 years the guidelines called for, I was sentenced to 32. And that was really the moment that I kind of gave up on my life. I just thought it was over. There's nothing left to do. Like, I've made these mistakes. I've caused this harm. Like, I'm done for. But then after a long series of things, in August of last year, I received a conditional pardon from the governor and got out after 19 years. So I was able to have this second chance. And what I see is that throughout this whole process, when I didn't believe in myself, I had people who believed in me and encouraged me and gave me support and resources. And I was able to turn my life around, to get a college degree, to become a journeyman electrician, to be a mentor, to do all these things, and to be successful now that I've gotten out. And that if we gave other people the same support and the same resources, I think we'd have a lot more success stories. So I'm out here advocating, not that, you know, everybody's going to be changed or everything's going to be fixed, but that if we give other people the same resources that I had, that I think we're going to have a lot more people succeed. And that's in everybody's interest.
I love that story, though. I mean, as an educator, I love giving support to kids of all different backgrounds and families. I know that families are impacted just the same as a prison. Hearing a 18-year-old being sentenced for 32 years is kind of insane to think about. Like, I mean, like, I know you're probably looking back and you're like, when I was 18, I was just barely out in the world. And it's like immediately you had to deal with, oh my gosh, nope, you're not in the real world anymore. Now you're going to go here, this other institution. But I'm glad that you're passionate about helping others like get out of their dark holes, as quote unquote, is a friendly way of putting it. But I would love to hear more about that, as well as like any success stories or some not so success stories that you've tried to help someone, but they didn't want to help themselves. You're welcome to tell us about that.
Sure. So it was early on in prison that I realized what I wanted to do. I had a roommate that I really liked, and he had come from this just horrible history of abuse and deprivation and just a really difficult childhood. Like, he came from one of the worst neighborhoods in his area, and everybody from that neighborhood used to say, yeah, like, that guy had it bad. Because even in that terrible place, he was the one who had it the worst. And so nobody in his family had ever gone to college. Most of his family had never graduated from high school or gotten a GED. So he'd been trying for years to get his GED while he was in, and just failing. Just couldn't pass the test, couldn't even pass. There were like three levels. There was like a TABE test, a pre-GED, and then a GED. He couldn't even pass the TABE test. There was just, it was hopeless. He would go to class every day, but he would hang his head down. And he was almost like John Coffey. He was giant. He was 6'6". He was 260 pounds, but he was really young. But to see this giant, sad guy who had a history of violence, and not necessarily because he's a violent person, but because he was raised in a violent environment, and he was taught the way you solve your problems is with violence. Like, the way you stay safe is with violence. But what I saw was a big kid. Like, that's actually what we called him, was Big Baby. And I love this dude to death because I saw this goodness in him, this innocence. Like, I remember when The Wizard of Oz came on TV, and he was so excited, and he went, and he was like, oh man, will you watch The Wizard of Oz with me? And I was like, dude, he's literally just a big kid. Like, all this dude needs is some help. So I made a deal with him. He was a heavyweight boxing champ at the prison I was at. So I said, hey, if you teach me to box, I'll teach you on your GED. Like, we'll make sure you get your GED. And so it was a difficult thing, but after about 3 months, I remember there was this moment where something we'd been struggling with for those 3 months, he finally got. It was like a light switch. And I was like, he's actually going to do this. Like, he's actually going to get his GED. And it was about 6 months total, and he did. He got his GED, passed the pretest. He got it, and he came back, and he picked me up and swung me around like a little kid, and he was just so happy. And it was like, that was when I realized I want to figure out a way to give back to other people, because I'm able to, you know, go to college. It took me 15 years inside, but I was able to get, you know, all this education. I was able to read as much as I wanted to learn things. I wanted to be able to give that back to other people. And he was really the beginning of that.
I
tutored guys on the inside. Yeah, it's one of my favorites. I tutored guys on the inside. I'm sorry.
You're good.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, that's adorable, because it's funny how the kids that are the biggest people, I know that this person you're talking about is not a child, but like the biggest kids sometimes comes from the roughest situation, but they are also the biggest teddy bears you will ever meet. Like, I mean, I'm only 5'4", and I have like a student who's my height in sixth grade, and I'm like, you're a big kid, and I'm like, but he's looked at me like multiple times. He's like, like there's a kid who picks on him who's smaller than him, and he's like, I can't hit him because if I do, I'll get in trouble. I can't do that. And I'm like, no, you should make the choice not to, because it looks bad on you as the bigger one. And he's just like he doesn't like to admit that. He's like, I can't hit a girl, that's not okay. And I'm like, see, that's a strong, resilient sixth grader. Like, the fact that he knows that he's not supposed to, like, that I was like, I'm impressed by that. And he's like, really? I'm like, you know better. Like, most kids your age would not know better. Go ahead, continue your story about tutoring on the inside.
Sure. So I worked with other people. I was a tutor in the plumbing class, teaching people the introductory math that they needed to be able to get their plumbing certification. I was a mentor in a mental health program, because one of the things we realized is there was very, very limited access to drug and alcohol treatment. And additionally, there's a huge proponent of mental illness in prison, and there just aren't enough mental health staff. Even though we had some really good psychologists and psych associates who wanted to be there, they were consistently understaffed or didn't have positions filled. And they just didn't have the resources, because you have that like kind of 5% of the seriously mentally ill prisoners that get 95% of the time, because they're engaging in acts of self-harm or suicidal ideation or actual acts of. And so there just isn't support for people. And we said, hey, we need to do something about this. We kept putting in all these proposals and talking to the psych ed. And finally, we got this peer support program started. And it was a pilot program where there were 7 of us who kind of went in, and we were the mentors. We were the ones who had some experience. We received a lot of additional training. And then we were the kind of resource there that people could relate to. Because the other thing is, a lot of people had been stigmatized by their mental illness to the point that they didn't want to talk to the psychologist. They felt like they were being, you know, talked as less than or being treated as their diagnosis, whereas we were just other prisoners. We were just other people who could relate to them and could maybe share something that they wouldn't be willing or able to receive from a psychologist. And we had a really wildly successful program that ended up being adopted statewide. And it was just really meaningful to have that role and realize that what I wanted to do. And additionally, of the 7 people who started in the mentor role, 3 of them received pardons and 1 of them received parole, which is only people who were sentenced before 1995. So there was this actual reward and acknowledgement of what we had accomplished that I thought was so gratifying. This process started on the inside.
That's really awesome, though. I've not heard of that program, but then again, we're not in the same state. So I think that's kind of cool that we're spreading this out and awareness of the program that you kind of helped found almost. And like, maybe other states can learn and look into this program that you have, or something like that. And I love how you're like, I found out what I want to do. Like, it was during your hardest time in your life, and you're like, I don't know what to do. People think I'm horrible. And it's like, there's still support for you. But like, at the same time, they're like, here, try this program, help us build this up. And you're like, probably you were very young and probably thinking, what? I'm a young person. Yeah, I don't know anything about mentoring another person or anything like that. I'm sure that was kind of like, in that first moment, you're like, me? Really? Because I know that sometimes when you're young, you think that you don't know everything, which you don't. A lot of my kids don't think they know everything, but they don't. But I think that's awesome that you mentored other prisoners. And also, it does seem like a better situation than talking to a therapist, because some people, even outside of prison, would not want to talk to it. Sometimes it's hard to go to a therapist and be like, I'd rather just have a friend that I can talk to about whatever. And it's like, sometimes that's all someone needs. It's just someone who's there for them and will listen. So,
sure.
And I did see, though, someone asked you if you wanted to be a lawyer, and you shot that down very quickly. Like, nope. I just thought that was funny. That's all.
Well, I worked in the law library for 5 years. So, you know, I researched precedent. I helped people with their cases. You know, I did. And I realized I just don't like that. Like, I could do the you know, courtroom stuff. I could do the presentation. But to do the back end, the research, it's the most onerous, uncomfortable, unpleasant thing I've ever done. Yeah. So it's like, no, I'd rather do pretty much anything else.
I just thought that was, like, I saw that when someone, like, I was like, I was really interested in that answer. And then immediately the video, you're like, no, no. Like, there was a quick, like, it was a quick video. It's like, nope, sorry, y'all. Just like, people have asked me if I want to be a principal one day. And I'm like, you know, no, I know what principals go through. That is a lot of interfering with the population around us. And I'd rather just support them and help them ease up their tension instead of having to be the person who has to go through the parents, to the school board, to every hiring process. And it's like, no, I would rather be on the level ground, not the higher ground. I like being able to be there.
Yeah. And it's kind of informed my process moving forward, though, is the peer support model. So since getting out, I've started a nonprofit that we're doing prison reentry classes, because there just aren't the resources, the classes, or the training available. And one of the things we decided to do was go with a peer support model, because we didn't want to have somebody at the front of the class telling people what they needed to do. And I didn't even want to have somebody who wasn't justice involved or hadn't been incarcerated telling somebody, you know, what they needed to do. So I hired a guy who had been kind of labeled the worst of the worst. He'd been in prison for 28 years. He'd been labeled incorrigible. He was the one that, you know, nobody wanted to see coming. And he's become so dedicated. Like, there was a light switch moment for whatever reason. And he's become dedicated to helping other people, like, realize that they have a different option. So he's the perfect person to teach this class. And this all came from my experience, you know, as a mentor in prison, or, you know, as a tutor in prison, recognizing that I can best relate to, and people can best relate to, those who have experiences in common.
I love that, though. It's like, sometimes the worst kid, like, he comes from the darkest place, so therefore he's like, I have the worst story you could ever hear, so you can't top me. And then it's like, what do you mean? And then he probably tells it, and a lot of people just go, oh, that was not what I expected from my instructor of some kind, and stuff like that. And I love that message of, like, you know, no matter how far down you go, you can still go back up, and stuff like that. And I do think that's important, though. With kids that I work with, they think that they're the worst thing ever is that they've, like, lost their pencil. And I'm like, it's not the worst thing. Like, they stole your pencil. Please don't. There's no reason to fight over a pencil. Like, there's absolutely no reason for it. And it's like, there might be something behind the scenes that I don't know, because, I mean, I don't live with every single child. I don't know. But it's just like, when the stories that I hear from kids sometimes amaze me, that I'm like, can I just sit with these kids? Do I have to teach them? Can I just, like, get to know them as people? Because that's feel like a lot of kids don't get that as often. We only have one guidance counselor, and she's busy across 3 grade levels. It's just insane. So it's like, can I just sit with them and talk and get to know them?
And I think that would be huge. I think that we would not have the need we do for incarceration if we had access to social services, access to enough counselors in school, if people were able to learn kind of practical life skills as well as academic topics in school. I think there's so much room for growth in addressing the issue before it gets out of control, but we just don't have the political will to really address that.
Yep. And definitely the life skills thing is something I really love doing. I know that, but for some reason, we've put that into a special education center. For some reason, they put those often with the kids who have the lower disabilities and stuff like that. At least in the state here, they've been doing that. And I'm like, I would love to teach that to every child, because I know some kids don't even know how to do their own laundry because mom or dad or grandma or aunt, uncle, whatever, has been doing their laundry. And they're like, I don't know, like, why is my socks pink when we do that? It's like, well, because you put a pink sock in your white load, like, that's going to happen. And so, like, that's something I wish I could do that. But standards and stuff like that of teaching is not friendly for that. I'd have to go back to school to get that licensure. And it's like, can I just start that? You know, like, have that whole program for them.
But it sounds like you're passionate about it. It sounds like something you'd be really good at.
Well, it's just, I've been in special education for like 3 years. I was doing it as a paraprofessional, and which is like right below a janitor, basically, like the person who's helping the teacher and doing all the grunt work, changing a lot of adult sized diapers. I really don't want to go back to be doing that. Sure. Like, I loved helping with their life school classes, but it's like, I wish we could do that for the general population, because some of these kids would really benefit from learning that. And I know in Georgia, where we live, but I work in Tennessee, in Georgia, they have like these programs for like welding and electrician and plumbing. And I'm like, this needs to be a thing in everywhere. Because like, I know that school is not for everybody. Even as an educator, I will say that. I will advocate, learn whatever you want to learn, not go, like, some are like, you don't want me to go to college. I'm like, you would probably be better if you didn't go to college, because you're much better suited for that. And I know parents come at me like, why are you telling my child they shouldn't go to college? I'm like, they're amazing artists. They could probably make money off of Patreon and DeviantArt and all those other art sites that are like out there now. Instagram is definitely full of those right now. So. And one of my best friend's sons, he's an electrician, HVAC, like, person. He's like, he works 24 days straight, and then he gets a month off. And it's like, good Lord, that is exhausting. But he loves what he does, and he makes good money doing it, because not a lot of people know how to do that now. So, and again, this podcast is all sorts of things.
Well, one of the things that's really positive, I mean, one of the teachers or the staff members that really kind of warmed my heart was an electrical teacher that I was under when I was going through my apprenticeship and then getting my journeyman's license. Because he was from a neighborhood where he was the only guy who didn't get arrested or didn't get killed. Like, he had been running around with his buddies, he'd been getting in trouble. And finally he had one of those wake-up moments where he was like, hey, I need to do things differently. Like, I see how it ended up for them. Like, not only do I need to get myself out of here, I need to figure out how I can help all the guys that I left behind. And so he became an electrician, then eventually got a master's HVAC license and had all these series of licenses to where he could just walk in the door and get $500 for walking in the door before he touched or diagnosed anything. But he realized that wasn't what he wanted to do, that he wanted to help the people who basically didn't have any hope. So he went and he worked in the prison. Even though he could have made as much money as you can imagine on the outside, he was working in the prison, teaching people basic electrical skills. And then not only that, he was relating, because he was a black man in the trades, which at least in Virginia is a rare thing. If you look at the maintenance departments, you look at the maintenance supervisors, it's very rare. And there's still some racial bias where it can be difficult to be a person of color to get on, you know, a crew or get into an apprenticeship. So he was trying to highlight it for the experience of saying, hey, this is what I do. This is how much I can charge. Like, this is an opportunity to change your life and, you know, have a different approach. And he connected guys with jobs. Like, we had all these pictures on the wall of guys that had gotten out and he had gotten them a job or a traveling job or they'd gotten licensed. And they were doing extremely well because of both the way that he had taught them and the opportunities that he gave them. And he single-handedly probably made a bigger impact on people's lives than anybody, or at least any other employee I saw in DOC.
That is completely awesome. I'm sure that's a pride wall too, though. It's like you probably saw some of your friends getting out that you're like, they had came in really rough, and then you see them on the wall and you're like, I need that one. I get to know that one. And like, you know, I'm sure they have the pride moment for you also getting out and helping other people. And so it's like, it's a full circle, which I love it. And I have a friend in Nashville. She used to work as a mental health therapist in a Nashville prison before, a women's prison. And she's like, she told different stories. And I'm like, I've never, you know, sat with her very long. So this is like, maybe this is an opportunity for me to go talk to her and see the comparison of like Nashville versus your experiences today. So you're just spurring some more conversations that I would like to have in the future. So thank you. I know that's
absolutely
not what you expected to come on a podcast that's small. We only had 250 downloads, but we're just like here to chat with people and get to know them and spread whatever message they want to. So that's kind of what I love about this is like, everyone's like, do you want any money out of it? I'm like, if I get money out of it, cool. But it's mostly just me getting to know people around the country, around the world, even if I had to, and see their stories. And the kids know I love stories. So I'm like, please tell me all about it. And they're like, you want to know the story? I'm like, yeah, go ahead. I call them my Cheetos. So they don't like that very much. At least the middle schoolers aren't. They're like, where are the Takis? And I'm like, okay, like, that's oddly specific branding here. Like, come on. But
My fiance is a reporter, and she says if she could get paid to run around and talk to people and find out what's going on and, like, listen into conversations and, you know, hear what's going on behind the scenes, that's what she wants to do. So she's constantly looking for a role that allows her to do that. So sounds like you'd be a good reporter, too.
Yeah, that's I also know that, and I've been told that when I started college, and everything's like, you're a good writer, you should do this. And I'm like, it's hard to get into that, y'all. That's half the battle is getting into somewhere, is getting into stepping in that door and like showing that, you know. So, and also I love that your fiance and yours love story was really cute. It was kind of just like, I can't be your reporter, I have to either be your friend or your reporter, but I'm not like I can't be both. And it's just like, I never thought about those two. Like, you have to like separate that to yourself, you're like in that day-to-day thing. I'm sure that was hard first few days though of that.
I mean, that's a really strict thing about ethics and reporting, because you have personal relationships with people you're reporting on. You can't be objective and you can't do your job. So I was just impressed that that's the kind of person that she is. She's really strict about it. She was very clear and said, hey, it's one or the other. Like, I can share this with you and we can be friends, or I can continue to report on you. And I think she was thinking, because she had gotten so many stories done. Like, I was a part of a story on the abolition of parole. She got stories done for us about abuses and children being strip searched and scabies outbreaks and these things that were big, that I think she felt like I would be afraid of losing a resource. But I was much more interested in having her as a friend, because there are a million reporters in the world. Like, you can get somebody to call them or send them an email, but when you find somebody you connect with, that's far more important than somebody being able to do a story.
Yeah, which is, a lot of people forget that, is that genuine connection is like half the battle right now. Is like, especially in COVID right now, this has been kind of crazy trying to make those connections from distance. And I'm sure like even in the early days, it's been kind of like, it's like you see each other through that glass wall or plastic or whatever. And it's like, you got to get to know them, but it's like, they're behind a wall, even with a mask behind them, they're still behind that wall. And that's like, I'm glad to be back in the classroom, but I also do miss the distance learning. My husband makes the joke though, that it's like, you miss the mute button for children. I'm like, doesn't everybody though? Like, every now and then when someone's talking your ear off about certain things that you're like, okay, I've heard this story 20 times. Let's save that for a minute. You know, like I've heard the same kid answer the same questions over and over. I'd like to hear some other voices. And he's like, okay, that mute button's not the same thing. And I'm like, no, it's just when they're screaming bloody murder for no reason. That's what I miss the mute button for. Well, the screaming is not the interactions and the stories they're telling me. It's just when they're being crazy kids. It's nice to hit that button of let's turn it down a little bit so that way my ears don't get accosted, is what I say, like that. So yeah, this podcast is a mess, I know, but it's just
okay. Well, so I was really grateful this morning. I had the opportunity. I'm not a religious person, but there was a minister who came to see me for 2 years before COVID, who was just, I mean, incredibly well-educated, had a doctorate in theology, had a master's in history, like has studied both the kind of like theology and history. And he said, hey, you know, I'm just here to talk. And he said, you know, when I went to talk at his church this morning, he said, you know, I had no idea why I was there. But then we had a conversation and Jesse was interested and I wanted to learn something and anything. I was in this very kind of like stimulation-less environment, and any opportunity to learn or see new things or, you know, meet with new people was really gratifying. And he said he got something out of the exchange as well. So again, I, you know, after 2 years of meeting this guy once a month in the prison, COVID hit, everything got shut down. But today I got to go speak at his church to the adult Sunday school class. And that was really meaningful because I have no idea how I'm going to be received. Like I've done speaking at law schools. I'm getting ready to go to San Francisco. I'm getting ready to go to Boston. And like, I'd never know what to expect at a corporate event or at a, you know, a church or at, you know, a school, because my story is kind of polarizing. Like I understand if somebody has a really negative reaction to it. But instead I've consistently gotten these really positive receptions and I've been able to have amazing conversations. And it's been really gratifying to have that experience because I never expected that. Like, this was not part of the plan.
Yeah, definitely. I definitely feel that this podcast, I never expected to, when I saw the 250 downloads yesterday or a couple of days ago, I was just like, wait, what? People are actually, you know, taking the time to download it or listen to it. I'm like, I am just a nerd person who lives with her husband in the middle of nowhere, Georgia, and they're listening to it anyway. And I'm like, I don't see how it's interesting, but, you know, here we are. And so it's like, a lot of people are like, it's, even my family doesn't listen to this podcast at all. Like, they don't even know I do this. So they're like, if I told them, hey, I had 250 downloads, they'd be like, on what? Like, what do you mean? And it's like, I didn't do in a podcast for almost a year now. And they're like, they'd probably be like, you're an introvert. You don't like people. It's like, but I am doing this little podcast in my spare time, which is like totally opposite of what an introvert does. But it's like small conversation, one-on-one conversation. That's what we thrive on.
And I would say that's definitely an experience for introverts, because I'm very introverted and like I'm drained anytime I have to go like work a room or like be in a crowd, but I engage with people one-on-one and that's really meaningful to me. Like I met one of my best friends on social media. We've never actually met in person, but he lives in Ireland and we have a Zoom call every Friday because we connected by being introverts in this world from radically different backgrounds and radically different kind of life paths, but somebody that I can really relate to and understand. And so the internet and social media has allowed me to make those meaningful one-on-one connections and not have to like wade through a room of busy people or try to go to a social event and find somebody to talk to, which I find much more difficult.
Yeah. Which like my husband is like the extrovert in the relationship. Definitely. He will gladly work a room and get to know people. And I'll be like, I would rather just give me the biographies of the people. And then I will talk to them. Like if I'm interested in talking to them, I'll go up to them. But like, don't make me go.
So you like vet people. You want people have to like send you a card and a pitch. Yeah. Like, here's why you should be my friend.
Yeah, pretty much. But like, I'm just like, I'm one of those like very analytical people because I have, my parents are both engineers. My brother's also one. And my dad was in the Navy also. So like, I have all this like military engineering brain, but I have no math skills to save my life. Like these poor kids. Like when I was doing the special ed thing, I'd have to be like reaching and trying to figure out how do I teach you to teach myself so I can like do all these different things. And they're like, this is so hard. I'm like, yeah, it is. But we're going to try to figure it out because you got to learn it this year because you're in fifth grade or sixth grade or 10th grade, you know, like that little stretch of, I don't know exactly everything about math, but we're going to still try anyway. And they're like, this is so hard. I'm like, trust me, math is one of my least favorite subjects, but I've learned how to adapt and fix it and make it easier. It's partially why I don't want to be a math teacher, is because it's like, I do all the weird ways to get to it. They're like, it's not how the standard goes. It's like, darn it. Well, that's how I found it. It's this weird offbeat way of figuring it out. And so they're often like, this is weird. I'm like, yeah, I've told the kids it's okay to be weird. Like, I have blue and pink hair right now as their teacher, and it threw them off the first time when I did it. And they're like, wait, what are you doing here with blue hair? And I'm like, I'm allowed to, because the principal said it was okay. And they're like, but why though? And I'm like, because I wanted to. You know, as an adult, we're allowed to make those adult decisions. And they're like, but why can't we do it? I'm like, that's between you and your parents, not between me and you. I can't tell you what to do. They're like, you're a teacher, you're supposed to. No, no, that's not the same conversation. So I can't teach you about how to dye your hair in class. Like, that's just not something I'd condone doing in the middle of classroom. But that's part of why I love education, is seeing those kids change and grow into the people they are now and stuff. And some of them are a lot taller than me, and they love to point it out. So, like, good, you're taller than a 5'4" person. They're like, I'm taller than you. I'm like, yes, that's not very tall, but good job. Like, I'm a very short person, so I like to do that.
Okay. Well, I mean, you're working towards a thing that is huge. I mean, there's not a lot of research about what actually happens in prison or what works in prison, but the one thing that's been consistently found is if there's a 5-to-1 ROI, or return on investment in education. So for every $1 invested in education, there's $5 saved by, you know, not having people return to prison and having to rearrest and retry and reincarcerate them, or by them actually contributing tax-wise. So it's a huge thing, and I think that you're in a position to have an impact, and I'm sure some of those kids' lives have been dramatically impacted by your influence.
It definitely, like, you don't see the impact until much later, and I'm sure you don't see the impact of your program that you're establishing now. And it's a relatively new program, so you still haven't seen the full, like, 10-year impact of it being around. But the fact that you're traveling to San Francisco and Boston and stuff should show you a little bit of a hint of that it's a pretty big deal, I hope.
It is. It's really neat. I had to cancel an event in Chicago where I was going to go network with a bunch of nonprofits and a friend. And I'm excited for that. I mean, this is, again, I've been out of prison today is actually 14 months. I realized that today. And that's not a normal trajectory for somebody. Like, you know, I've got a buddy who's been out 2 years who's still scrambling. He's still living paycheck to paycheck. I still, you know, I've had incredible fortune and I've had incredible opportunities, and I'm connected to that every day. Like, it helps me be grateful because the contrast is so big. Like, if you had always had something, you may not appreciate it. But when literally just being able to walk outside, or being able to, you know, make a real cup of coffee in the morning, or being able to, you know, see my fiance, those things are magical, because didn't have them for so long.
So. Yeah, I love the story of you, like, when you said smashing concrete from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. or whatever 6 p.m. to 6 a.m., whatever that shift was. But it was like, you're like, the being able to see the stars was like something that you had, like, hadn't done in so long, that you're like, when you hear that out loud, you're like, that's not a big deal. But, like, to you, it was like the biggest deal on the planet, probably in that moment, that you're like, wow, I'm doing this right now. The smashing concrete has gotten me here. So there's gotta be a reason behind why we're doing this. And I've had that moment before. Not in prison. I've never been to prison myself. I've visited prisons before, but never been a prisoner. But, we had to work in a brush, like, thing in Alabama when those tornadoes came through Alabama, those terrible ones. Like, there was a ton of brush cleanup, and, like, a log was covered in fire ants, like, absolute fire ants everywhere. If you know you're a deep South person, fire ants are really evil and they really hurt. Try listing a log full of them, but with no gloves on. Like, that really hurts. So, like, but having that, but then after we cleaned it up and got rid of it and killed all those fire ants, the cheese sandwich that we had right after that was probably the best cheese sandwich I've ever had. It was cold and it was delicious, but it was like, my hands were like so swollen up and red. It was like, on paper, this sounds like a silly story to be like, I'm grateful for cheese sandwich right now, but my hands were like so red. It was like that cold cheese just felt good. And it was American cheese, and we know that's not actual cheese. So, but that, like, that story reminded me of that when I was cleaning the brush, when I saw your story about your stars and stuff like that. It was like, same kind of feel of, like, you don't realize it in the moment till you look up and stuff like that.
So. Somebody told me a long time ago that there's a quote that gratitude makes whatever you have into enough. And I really found that to be true. That focusing on gratitude for where I'm at and what I have, regardless of whether that's a lot or a little, whether that's having a cheese sandwich or having, you know, food from the chow hall in prison, or being out here in the multitude of things that I have, focusing on that gratitude makes wherever I am into enough. And knowing that, really understanding that, just kind of radically transformed my life.
Yeah. Which, it's like, it's the small things, like little things like that, are just like things that we don't think about in that moment until later on. It's like, oh yeah, we've done this big thing. And it's like, it's not a huge thing in that moment. You think, oh, this is just I've been looking at stars. This is not at like midnight o'clock. It's like, that doesn't sound like a big deal. But when it's like, when you've been inside and staring at fluorescent lights almost for however many years, those stars are nice and comforting. And then it's like, this is actually really pretty and really nice and stuff like that. Like, don't think about it. So I'm glad for the, like, I know it's just a random scroll on Instagram. When I reached out to you, I was like, if he responds, I'm going to be amazed. But if he doesn't, like, you know, like, oh, well, like, it's the next person, you know. I've been trying to meet people different from myself. So it's like, let's just see if he actually, because most people will think I'm a spam message. So often I would go like, this is not a spam message. Please read this all the way through. Like, I have to like sell that and, because I've gotten so many spam messages, I try to avoid that and just be like, this is not a spam, because I know that there's people out there who take advantage of people online, and it's annoying. I really could get on a soapbox about how annoying they are, but sure. Like, I tried to be like, let's see if he says yes or no, and I know he's busy doing his nonprofit, and he's making his little Instagram reels walking around, so let's see if he responds to it. So we're grateful that you showed up here.
Well, it was the thing that, you know, a year ago, I mean, I guess a little more than a year ago at this point, I had no idea that I would ever do anything on social media. Like, the first video I did thinking that it was going to be a record for me and for my friends to, like, remember where I'd come from and kind of document that. And when it had the number of views it had, or when I got the number of followers I had, you know, a day and a week later, it was like, wait, this is something different. Like, this is bizarre. And so connecting with people that are trying to do the same thing, whether you're trying to tell your story or trying to tell other people's stories, we're all coming from the same place. And there's really... there's just a lot of luck and happenstance involved. So I'm just as happy to do your podcast as to go do, you know, one of these big professional podcasts, because why not? Like, we're all coming from the same place, and we're all trying to connect in some meaningful way. And I think that's cool.
Yeah. And I know I'm a very small podcast. So like, a lot of people are like, oh, what kind of listenerships do you have? Do you have sponsorship? And I'm just like, no, we don't have any of that fancy stuff whatsoever. And a lot of people are like, oh, and some people like will ghost, quote unquote, and like leave, and it's like, well, that's fine. Like, it's people who take a chance on it, I really appreciate, because it's like, I know people have lives outside of all sorts of social media frames, as well as like work stuff. And it's like, if people take a chance, I always say thank you tremendously. Like, I this past episode, I literally spent like, I think 20 or so minutes just saying thank you to the guests that have been on so far, just because I was like, you took a chance to come on this podcast, and it's like, we're not a professional one. We do not have an audio engineer. We don't have any fancy equipment, like, at all. So it's like, I'm still learning how to use it. And so it's just like a spur of the moment. Let's start a podcast last year. And it's like, okay, like, never done it before. I listened to them. I have no idea what they're going to entail. And it's like, now it's 250 downloads and 20 episodes later. We're still making them. Stuff like that. It's kind of crazy.
There you go. Well, the first podcast I did was with Courtney, my now fiance, over the prison phone. So it was really crackly and really bad quality. And she would just record it into another phone. And then the one I did the other day was bizarre, because it actually had like, I've had like an audio engineer, or like one manager or whatever. This had like 17 people on it. They're like checking in, they're doing mics. And I was like, this is not, like, this seems much above and beyond what's probably needed. But it was, you know, really high quality, and I get why they did it. So it's a neat experience.
Yeah, definitely. Like, I mean, I'd rather have a small conversation like we're having right now than having a big fancy, like, okay, one mic checks, make sure your mic is on, make sure your camera's all got the nice background, all the solid background, so we can edit the background and edit you into the video. And it's like, that is a lot of work. And I commend those who do that on a day to day, like those big, huge podcasters who do it every day, like the CNN posts and all those other people. I'm like, but that is not something I want this to turn into. I like to have the conversations, those real conversations, not the heavy duty, like, okay, tell me about your life story. Okay, we're going to talk with your childhood. We're going to talk about your adolescence. It's like, that can kind of make people feel more nervous. Cause like if you're talking about some certain topics, cause like, if I go back to my childhood, I'd be like, do I really have to talk about that childhood experience? Not really. But I know that some people are interested in that, but like, those are the podcasts I usually avoid, just for the sake of like, if I want a biography, I will buy one on the bookshelf or get an audiobook. But it's like, I'd rather just know the person as a person, not a, let's ask these stereotypical questions. Like, where did you grow up? Well, I grew up in here. It's like, I went to this high school and this, like, we were like this in high school. It's like, were you the nerd in high school? Yes. Okay. It's like, well, how does that really know a person? It's like, it's a very easy way to record it that way, because you can, it's the same across every single board and you can cut it and stuff like that, but it just doesn't seem real when I listen to that.
So, I remember seeing somewhere that somebody recommended, rather than asking somebody, well, what do you do or where are you from, the first question we should ask anybody in an encounter is, in what way are you messed up? Like, in what way are you, like, different from everybody else? And I thought that was a great question, because we all have our own, like, traumas and forces in our lives, and we all have the things we struggle with. And I think it could lead to, like, trauma bonding or something unhealthy. But in another way, it could just kind of break down those barriers and have a really real raw conversation. Like, one of my favorite stories about Courtney and I meeting new people, this was, like, 2 weeks out of prison or something. We went to a wedding, and we were back at the, like, the outcast table. Like, we weren't really close with the groom and really close with the brides. We're just the random people. And everybody gave these really sanitized versions of these stories around themselves. They're like, oh, yeah, we met when we were working at so-and-so. We did whatever. And then Courtney and I introduced ourselves, and she gave the whole story about meeting while I was in prison and how... And the other person was like, I have to be honest, we met while we were doing drugs. Like, we didn't meet at the office. Like, and so this rawness and this honesty came out, which I thought was so neat, because it became a much more genuine conversation rather than the kind of, like, social protocol of saying, oh, well, I work here, and yes, I really like what I do, and the kind of false facade we put on.
Yeah, which I don't like that either. And I understand that, like, too. Like, I mean, when I visit my family, sometimes it is like that. And it's like, guys, we are all related to each other. We all know how we have our, like, on one side of my family, it's like work-based work, but they all almost will work for the same company. And so it's just like, y'all spend almost 24 hours together. Yes, I know you're siblings and you're all, like, related and stuff like that, but it's just like, can we not talk about the same work stuff? Like, can we talk about, like, what you're doing this weekend on Labor Day weekend that's fun? Like, can we not talk about the little insurance, like the insurance sales or the sale product numbers and, like, all these recall, that's the word I wanted, the recalls that are going on. Like, do we have to talk about that at the Thanksgiving table? You know, like, come on, let's talk about something else. Because, I mean, they all, when they ask me, they're like, what are you teaching this week? What are you talking about that in class? And I'm like, that's the only thing you want to know? Like, you don't even want to know what the kids are doing? Like, if it's homecoming week or, you know, spirit week or something, you don't want to know anything like that. You just want to know what standards we're teaching, because like, that's not all education is. It's like, I've had kids that have grown, matured a lot better, but not about education. Like, I've seen them grow into a more artistic personality and dyeing their hair rainbow just for Pride Month because they came out. That was their way of coming out. It's like, I don't teach that, but like, they're like, is it okay if I do that? I'm like, it's your hair. I don't think I would want to dye my hair rainbow, but that's just because that's a lot of hair dye in my face. And they're like, oh, is that a problem? You don't like that? I'm like, no, I did not say that. I just was saying, like, if that's something you want to do as a 15-year-old person, you can do that. Like, I'm not the one who's going to tell you right or wrong about that situation. If you want my opinion, we'll talk about it outside of school, because technically I'm not supposed to in a school, like, spread that awareness. But they're always just like, you know about this stuff. Like, yeah. It's like, I'm a millennial teacher. Of course I know about that, because I'm not that much older than y'all. And they're like, but how? And I'm like, I've seen the meme of like, how old are you, mom or dad? And it's like 19. And they're like, 19? What do you mean? It's like 19 is now a denoter of a lot older than them. So when they hear the 19 at the beginning of the school of the year they were born, it's a cue for them to go, you're older than 20? It's like, yes. Because the kids who were 20, born in 2000, are now 22 and 21, so, which is crazy to think about.
I agree. It's still shocking to me.
Yeah, when I see these birthdays, I'm just like, you're 12 and you were born. Oh, wow, you could have been my child if I had had a child in high school. Like, that really freaks me out a little bit. They're like, what do you mean? I'm like, nope, not. I'm not digging into that hole, because it seems like a rabbit hole that will get me in trouble. Because it's like, your parents are mine.
I went to prison in 2002, and some of my friends have kids that are grown now. And that's just shocking to me, because my life kind of stopped at that, you know, 17 or 18. And they've lived these full lives. They've had, you know, careers. They've raised kids. They've, like, kind of gone to the next chapter of their lives. And I still feel like, in many ways, I'm this, you know, 18-year-old kid finding his way in the world.
And I mean, those 18-year-olds now, though, are still learning, like, the life, how life works and stuff like that. And it's like, yeah, it's different from what you expect. It's definitely, like, I have students who are now 16, they're going to be 17 like in 16 and 17. I have kids also who graduated high school last year. I have kids who are graduating high school now and ones that are graduating college. And I'm like, I'm not even like, college doesn't feel that far away from me, but it's like, yeah, these are the kids I used to babysit because they were like 10 and 11 when I was like 16 or 17. It's like, that's weird to think about that age bracket. And it's like, and one of my friends who babysat me when I was 10 was like, well, how do you think I feel when I saw you get married and, you know, that you're teaching now and you have a master's degree? How do you think I felt? And I'm like, oh, like, I'm sorry. Like, didn't mean to make you feel older and wiser. And she's like, it's okay. I have a kid that's like 5. So I don't think that's a big deal. Like, okay. Well, I know how it feels now.
So. Well, it is our last night together because we have a really big week coming up. So I have to go spend some time with Courtney. It's our date night. But no. I appreciate you having me on. And thank you. Yeah, I wish you continued success.
All right, I'm going to stop recording. So thank you again, everybody. Thank Jesse for joining us on his date night. And so we'll give him some good, little good vibes for him. And thank you again, guys. All right, bye.